Football Show on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
I'm prepared to do anything I can to play the country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should it be an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
All right, you're welcome along. It is Wednesday's football show. Nathan and Dan in studio with you. 53106 is the text number. Manchester United 0, Wolves 0, 61 minutes gone at Old Trafford in the FA Cup third round replay. Two strong sides.
Yeah, taking it seriously.
Matt Doherty at the post.
Yeah, I haven't seen too much now. He's finishing some stuff, but...
Some exclusives for the morning.
Just working away. The FAI just doesn't... The FAI never sleeps.
Nobody reads papers anymore. Tell us.
If you say that again, I'll hit you. No, it's...
It hurts.
It's still
going well.
You still have to get your radio show information from somewhere.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I look forward to your paper review. Is that going to be your start, is it?
We bought the
papers. Is this
we're trying to keep it alive.
Some of the content you do on OGBM.
We're trying to keep it alive.
Yeah. Just remember, yeah. Because you're not dead air otherwise.
Wow, he's pretty confident.
You went for my entire profession there. I mean, what do you expect?
All in one.
What do you expect? I was doing some work anyway. You're just grumpy because you've been here for a long, long time today.
That's
really
fine.
What it's all about.
It's fine.
Have you seen Cristiano Ronaldo's regime for like being super healthy and fit? Is that like I'm not comparing you to Ronaldo. It's like 5 90-minute naps in a day rather than a full night's sleep. Apparently,
that would be glorious.
It's like a long series of power naps.
See, this is one of these bullshit things that someone puts up online. It's like all those quotes about Paul Scholes.
Yeah.
They're not real.
Well, I'm taking that it's true.
Okay, so go on. Go on, give us the highlights.
No, I don't have the full list, but
okay.
The highlight was
we'll have a
no red meat, no fizzy drinks, whatever. Salad with every meal. I'm trying to think what else I remembered seeing.
I saw that. Salad with every meal.
I mean,
like, what did people think Cristiano Ronaldo was eating? Oh, chips with every meal.
Yeah, like a
five times a day.
Portion of onion rings.
What did you say this was called? Cristiano Ronaldo's, is it his guide to life or?
Oh, it's just how to keep fitter. I can't remember what it was. But the fact that he doesn't have one sustained night, like sleep. It's like sort of five long power naps across the day. Imagine it might be hard to manage that in an away trip and stuff.
The other thing
I am skeptical, but I was just because you're a bit tired and cranky.
He loves chicken. Chicken is a superfood.
Yeah.
For Cristiano Ronaldo.
Yeah, this is
no other athlete has discovered this.
That's what keeps him going. Yeah, no, it's...
Like, there's nobody has 5 90-minute naps, which is what? About 7? No.
Yeah, it'd be 5. It'd be like...
7.5 hours sleep?
Yeah, it's not bad. I'd be pretty happy with 7.5 hours sleep on average
seven,
a day,
and
you know?
Hours. But eventually you just want a good sleep.
I mean, I can't imagine he's consistent with this the whole time.
So if he goes to bed at 1 a.m, he's up again at half two. What'll I do now?
Does seem a bit odd, doesn't it, really? We'll have some chicken, I presume.
Yeah. Have you heard of this thing? And a bit of salad on the side.
A salad, of course. I mean, a bit of salad on the side, I mean, isn't that quite common when you overseas anyway when you have a meal, you know?
I bet you he's sculling pints as well.
Oh, yeah, I'm no doubt. No doubt he is.
This guy.
He's
the secret that
not
he has by
that.
Being one of the
Yeah,
well,
anyway, listen,
in the
people
world.
Have probably seen that during the rounds. It may not be true.
It may not be true, but listen, it got us through the first 5 minutes of the news round. So Manchester United Wolves is... Well, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer in the build-up has spoken about how seriously they're taking the FA Cup, which was sort of putting a rod in his own back, you feel, when they don't do well in the FA Cup.
Do without, you know, going out of the competition this evening because he can't really downplay it as a no-big thing because the side you've picked...
Like, the only real changes they've made, all right, possibly their two best players, they've taken David De Gea and Marcus Rashford out of the side and went with Martial up front. Wolves as well, changed goalkeeper, John Ruddy's playing instead of Rui Patricio, but aside from that again, they're almost at full strength. Like, they've gone with Neves and Moutinho, Doherty and Johnny are there, Jimenez is playing up front.
Yeah, and like, they are, I know, like, Wolves have had the Europa League commitments this season, and that's always difficult adjustment for a team, although, I mean, they've done well. But like, they are the type of team that probably should be taking the FA Cup quite seriously because Wolves are a good side. They're not going to be. They're in no relegation trouble. You know, they're still in the midst of like a battle for European places and so on. If they had an exceptional end to the season, but it is something for them, like for Wolves. It would be huge, you know, to somehow get there. So I can see why they're, you get disappointed. Sometimes, like, people talk about the status of the FA Cup, and it's actually the mid-table FA Cup teams who do, and the relegation threatened ones, who do more damage than the top clubs. Like, the top clubs will generally sort of get through anyway, and then as it goes on, it becomes a bit of an event for them. It's actually the teams that never win a trophy, you know, that are so willing to sack it off. That's the problem sometimes.
Well, Wolves obviously probably feel they have a point to prove as well. You think back to last season, the semi-final against Watford.
Not again.
Absolute control.
Well, actually, yeah. And to be honest, yeah, they had all that excitement. And it's funny, that actually nearly forgotten about it, how the FA Cup, they don't always live in the memory. But it was almost being scripted that way. That,
you know, how I love to go down to Grafton Street and get the people's opinion.
Well, this is something that you really enjoy doing.
It's a real good judge of the nation, I think, walking down Grafton Street and finding
nothing,
out.
Nothing sort of measures the pulse of the sporting nation quite like the people, the hardcore that you find on Grafton Street.
Preferably outside Brian Thomas. Oh, between Brian Thomas and Marks and Spencer's, that exact area, I think, is
that's the heartbeat.
The heartbeat of the nation. How many of them do you think, if we ask them, and it's the age-old conversation at this stage, if we ask them who played in last season's FA Cup final, would remember?
Depends. Like, yeah, as a percentage, you'd imagine it'd be pretty low. They might be dancing on the streets of Grafton Street now, though, are they?
Goal for Manchester United.
They're spilling onto Grafton Street.
Quick fire counter attack, one end of the pitch to the other. And Juan Mata, of all people, was the one who finished it off. A little dinked finish over the onrushing John Ruddy. There was a breakdown in midfield where it looked like there was a bit of a coming together. Juan Mata's pushing his hair back in.
They're having a bit of a VAR chat here, potentially.
So it was just a long clearance forward, ball bounced over two Wolves defenders, and then played through to Juan Mata, who's definitely onside.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what they could be complaining about. Was Cody appealing for maybe a push? So this was just a long clearance forward from the edge of United's own area, and it bounced over two Wolves defenders. So unless they feel there was a little bit of a nudge in the back, it was a lovely little dink.
Cody's running off with his arm in the air with a sort of an offside style
gesture. Definitely not offside.
They're going to be screwed if that's their strategy. They need to find something much more finicky to meet the VAR criteria.
Manchester United 1, Wolves 0. Wolves did have a goal disallowed for VAR in the first half. Mm. Pedro Neto for one of these handballs that was unintentional, but the rule is very clear that if it touches your hand in any way, the goal is ruled out.
It's very much weighted against the attacker, that rule.
That is one of the stranger rules.
Yeah.
Because we saw it right at the start of the season, Manchester City and Tottenham, when City had that late winner ruled off for a completely unintentional handball. And they obviously decided that we don't want it to be subjective for referees anymore in terms of handballs in the build-up to goals. That it's very straight down the middle. But like, why just stop there?
Like, except it is for defenders. That's the thing.
Like everything is subjective when it comes to refereeing.
Yeah.
So do you bring in if you touch the ankle of a player...
Yeah, no, like
an automatic free kick. But you wouldn't do that. So why have this?
Yeah, no, it's true. Honestly, we can't get into our rabbit hole again. But I agree with all of your grievances about this particularly egregious topic.
Let's talk about the FAI, Dan.
Yeah, well, I was in.
Let's go down
that
particular rabbit hole.
I was back in Leinster House. I don't really have a sort of a nickname for it yet. You know, just down Kildare Street, Leinster House. You know, the doll. I mean, there was something else.
Is that your nickname?
No, it's not my nickname. But you know, it's not like I don't know the various the like. There's obviously there was a lot of activity yesterday. Like the sort of the out the front is where all the people were setting up for the election announcement day statements and promises and declarations. So at various intervals, although you know everyone's in the house and all the political correspondents are in the house, they still have to do the big press conference out in the street. So at various intervals, like the political people come out and then there's a big walk from out the front down the steps so you can have the camera shot of them walking towards you. But in the midst of it all yesterday, you had some European officials, four officials from UEFA, slightly perplexed by going through, had to get their passes, you know, go around into government buildings. Not really was all this activity for them. I mean, some of it was for them, some of it was for Sinn Féin, who were nearby at the time, but camera crews and whatnot. So yeah, we are now 10 months in.
So yesterday, obviously, the election was called. Just before we get into some of the stories emerging today, Shane Ross, you'd have to imagine there's every likelihood, whatever way the next government is formed, is probably not going to be the Minister of Sport. he may well end up moving to a different portfolio. He may not be part of the government. We don't know, but the way these things work, it's probably highly unlikely he'll end up in the same ministry again. Is that going to have any impact, do you feel, on what happens in the FAI?
Yeah, it's a valid question. It's something that obviously has been raised. I think it was raised directly to Shane Ross yesterday, and he didn't think that this would be a problem. What it does seem as though, I'm not sure if we're going to have some quick resolution here, rapid fire, that sort of, you know, happens all before the election. So there's certainly going to be a lot of matters, I think, outstanding then. There is, like, sort of, you know, people working in the department, officials, who are very much engaged in all these talks, who aren't going anywhere. So I think that there's not going to be a... If there is a change, it's not as if there's going to be a whole new team coming in who are completely unaware of anything that's been going on, and it's an opportunity for people to come in, well, let's go and pitch to them. Yeah, there's always a danger, you know, that you have a minister who comes in with a completely different perspective on the whole thing. And I say a danger because I say that in the context now of, I do think that there's probably a lot of eyes on the FAI at the moment, and the reforms and whatnot. And I can't imagine that a minister who come in now who had a slightly more hands-off approach, that would be welcomed at this point.
So Shane Ross has been pretty consistent with his attitude towards the FAI throughout the last few months, that they need to cut ties with the previous regime completely. If funding is to be restored and if the dialogue is to be restored. It seemed as though we had that breakthrough last week with the independent directors being confirmed. I think when we spoke last Thursday night, we talked about how far he wants that reform to go, because the council is the next chain down and they all remain, and they are very much part of that previous regime.
Yeah, they have a shelf life council for 3 years, but they are still... They're going to be in the room. There's going to be ex-board members, you know, on the council floor.
And you have a story today that John Airlie, who's a name who has come up many times over...
Yeah, he was one of the two board members who was the last to leave.
So he was the representative at the time of the Schoolboys Football
SFAI. And, you know, he's on the board since 2015. He did resign briefly last year due to governance reforms, but then came back in at the AGM, where both himself and Donald Conway got one more year. But then eventually, last month, I guess in response to pressure...
Well, he said, in the interest of facilitating a new beginning for the FAI...
Yes.
...he stepped down.
But what we have now is... See, people don't know a huge amount about I suppose, the power structures of the FAI. I mean, I guess people either didn't pay attention before, wasn't that big a story.
Well, this is the exact same situation in every major sport it feels in this country.
Yeah.
It's the exact same when we have issues within the GAA and people talk about Central Council and Congress, that people don't really know who those making the decisions are.
How it operates. And it happens at all levels. I mean, it happens in political world, it happens whatever, there's committees and whatnot. And, like, this isn't a personalised thing. It's just something that I think is quite relevant to raise. And it did get a bit of a reaction today. So when the governance reforms were brought in, there's a number of committees that exist. It's not just the FAI board. There's like a football management committee. There's various committees that deal with, you know, club competitions. You know, there's a women's football committee. And one of these is the International High Performance Committee, which if you read the job spec or the skills and expertise required at the FAI advertise, don't quite have it in front of me, but deals with, you know, business management, legal and regulatory, various levels of expertise, and then elite management, coaching, playing expertise and so on. But it was designated in the governance reforms that there would be one person from, say, disaffiliate, one person from that, so like one from women's football, one from the schools, one from the Schoolboy Football Association of Ireland, and they have nominated John Airlie to go forward. And so today, John Airlie was in Abbottstown in a meeting which took place in the boardroom. A month after leaving the FAI, he's back in Abbottstown today on an international high performance committee. Now, some people would argue, well, the SFAI have put him there, and, you know, he stepped away from the board, but he's still entitled to participate in football and so on. And
well, there's no argument about that. Like, he was put there by the SFAI.
They put him there. But the optics of it, that you have had a big sort of drive to say, you know, that we need change, that the people who were there during the Delaney years just need to be moved, you know, to be moved on and whatever. And it's been acknowledged, you know, that, yes, people weren't always aware of everything that was happening. I'm not saying that they were supportive of everything that happened. But the fact now that you now have a situation where these committees that have been created may still have ex-board members, do have ex-board members on them. You know, positions that are national committees that will come together, and you can debate the level of influence. And people seem a bit perplexed that this has been reported, because again, before, no one ever paid attention who was on these committees. It's a bit of a surprise that this is a talking
Have you any
point.
Idea actually what their influence is?
Well, no, that's
what sort of powers
this,
they have.
This is to be decided. I mean, they are in theory meant to shape strategy that's gone up the line. Now, unfortunately, how effective have these committees been over the year? I mean, there was a finance committee, there was a finance and there was an audit risk committee, and you know, in the examination of the FEI's structures, it was a case of, well, how do these committees function? But if we have a situation with these FEI, these new FEI committees after governance reform, that they're just being populated, you know, from people from various bodies who you would question whether they have the skill set for these particular committees. And in particular, someone who has been on the board till very recently, coming back, you know, being an abstain on another national committee that is looking at strategy and issues, I think it's a very valid point to raise, that is this appropriate?
Yeah,
and I think that's my point, that I think it's certainly questionable. It definitely has surprised, from what I can gather, it has surprised people in the, I suppose, in the area of government, and people who have made statements about, well, the old guard has been excised, perhaps not knowing that these board members are actually still going to be returned to seats at just down the food chain a small bit.
And the SFAI are entitled to elect whoever they feel is the best representative for them on this committee. But again, it does just raise questions as to, with all that's gone on over the last 10 months, have people not realised that everyone wants change?
Yeah.
Or maybe we're getting this wrong, and actually, at grassroots level, there are people who think they want some change, but not.
Yeah, that's possible. And they might think, and again, it's like, well, you know, well, they've done well for our constituency at various times, so we're happy with them there. I mean, there's another, like, you know, another member of the committee, Dennis Cruz, is one of the people who signed, from the junior council, who signed one of the letters that came out in support of John Day, one of those, the provincial associations and the junior council, back in March. Now, at the recent FEI AGM, there was conflicting opinions. There was someone who stood up, I think from St Patrick's CY, and said anyone who signed those statements, you know, they need to be moved along. Other people would take a slightly different view. So, well, they've served for X amount of years. But I do think what we're coming back to here, and let's get that, it's about a slightly battered image of the FEI. They're looking for state funding. They need state support for whatever deal is going to be done now. And they need everything to be seen to be in keeping with an attitude that is geared towards, we're looking to the future. And when you've made a big song and dance over, yes, we have moved on these board members, we have told people what, you know, we've almost respected the wishes, we accepted people need to move along, Donal Conway is stepping down. If these ex-board members suddenly start reappearing at committees where they can have influence, then that doesn't really strike you as a new era. Like, the
is
board
that
can
realistic,
do so much.
Though? Is that realistic to think that just because the old regime is gone, that the new FAI is going to be this beautiful structure, almost a socialist structure, where everybody gets a little bit and everybody's happy with that? Like, surely that's not the case. That organisations, and the more likely scenario is actually a lot of organisations that maybe are quite well organised underneath, see this as an opportunity to gain some more power.
But that is always the danger. There's always there's a vacuum there, and like there's always going to be a problem that you know, people can see opportunity in that. And you are right about, you know, it's in an ideal world, it's not just going to just be solved straight away. And some of these committee places that were laid down in the governance reforms, they wouldn't have been voted through if they'd proposed a more radical structure. So I do appreciate that they probably couldn't, you know, what was voted last July had to be maybe step one. But I also think that there's a lot of eyes on football now, and it's as much of a chance as you've ever had to actually, you know,
put in place a proper structure.
Yeah, devise a culture where actually seats in these committees mean something. Like, not any of the people we've mentioned here, but I've spoken to people, you know, who are going forward committees who basically admitted that they have no real interest in football beyond the particular interest of their particular grouping and interest they're looking for.
So they got involved in their local community team.
Yeah, and they're passionate about maybe a particular cause, whatever it might be. But they're now in a situation where they're going to be on committees that in theory are meant to be devising strategy. Like that International High Performance Committee, Ainio Gorman is on it as an ex-Irish international player. Now, they do have the scope to co-opt more people onto it. But like that, in terms of like elite playing experience, like there's maybe one or two people on that of 11, 12 who are actually sort of specialists in that area.
Yeah, presumably so, while that group is led by Rude Doctor, in a way Rude Doctor should be answering to that group, that it's in charge of that high performance structure, and I know Rude Doctor every 4 or 5 years has to come up with a new high performance structure.
Yeah, it's a talking
constant development.
It's where people with ideas sit around the table and talk to you, and you know, are they people who are qualified for this particular committee? And as I said, a lot of these, like there was, it's this may not, you know, when there was a finance committee and audit risk committees, people asked, what are these committees doing? And it just seems to be a culture of these committees, well, they don't really matter. Do they matter? We can just put our men on them so we have our sort of union, our area, our sort of facet of the game represented. And I just don't think that that serves Irish football well. So I think it's important to shine light on this stuff, because I don't think it looks great in the eyes of presenting an image of having moved on.
Very briefly then, just so we can move on from this, like Shane Ross and his talk of reform, when he, I'm sure, has been reading about this and hearing about this, do you expect that it will become an issue?
I don't think it looks great. So I think I got the sense, you know, you obviously get reaction to something, you know, to the pieces that you write or whatever, and because people do notice what's in the papers. And I think it's
just
raised
in the papers.
It's raised awareness of just to be conscious of that the ex-board members and people, just because they're not necessarily at the top table and at the front of the house, doesn't mean that they're gone away either.
At least we've been able to amplify the story here on the radio.
Yeah, no, it's good.
It's a big audience.
It's a mutual appreciation, so we shouldn't insult each other, Nathan.
Awestruck Kevin just saw Ronaldo in Hillbillies noshing on 5 chicken goujons. He's an example to us all.
Are you just looking for Hillbillies to send in some stuff again?
No, again, apparently we got a load of... Well, no, we got vouchers for Hillbillies. Where is my closest Hillbillies? Is this a Northside thing? Or at Mines? I'm going to be going past it this evening.
Isn't Hillbillies massive?
JP had a free...
It's massive
salad.
In Cork.
You went
in
to Hillbilly. Is Hillbilly's not a takeaway?
No, it's like
it's a chipper.
In. You can sit in.
You went to the chipper and you got a chicken salad.
There's one in Fairview, I think.
That is Cristiano Ronaldo, a living, breathing example of...
Yeah, he's actually just finished
living the Cristiano life.
He's finished his 90-minute nap in there now. He's come back to life.
Actually, that does sound about right for JP. Is Parrott being left off because he hasn't signed a contract extension yet? Wonders James in Cork.
It's a point to raise. Definitely, you do see it with a young player on occasion that, there's a bit of brinkmanship with the scenario.
We will get into that with Charlie Eccleshire in a few moments' time. Darren Randolph, then, confirmation the deal is done. He has gone back to West Ham, 32 years of age, very much the Republic of Ireland number one for the last 4 years. A 3.5-year deal for the 32-year-old from Middlesbrough. He had been delayed because of a thigh injury. But it has gone through. Lukasz Fabianski currently unavailable. He has a hip injury. Their backup keeper, Roberto, has been an unmitigated disaster.
Mm.
But Lukasz Fabianski seems to be very highly rated.
Oh, they love him.
So Darren Randolph, it does seem, is going there to be the number two. Probably on twice the wages he was on at Middlesbrough. But still, we are very much looking at this through green-tinted glasses.
Yeah.
From an Irish point of view, like, are we facing the possibility that he's going into a playoff not having played in 2 months?
The good thing is Fabianski has an aggravated hip problem. So hopefully, like, the ideal scenario, like, Darren Randolph came into the game in November against Denmark possibly carrying an injury. You know, definitely wasn't 100%. I think that was obvious. But still, you know, he's very, very important to Ireland. So really, with a very selfish March perspective in mind, because he hasn't played since the end of November, and Randolph to come in now, he can play 4 or 5 games, and if Fabianski comes back and he has to come in, and so be it. Randolph can then sort of mind himself and peak perfectly for the playoff. So I think in the short term, it wouldn't be a concern from an Irish perspective. Longer term, it's a bit more of a worry.
Well, it is, particularly because the goalkeeping position is the most nailed on. There's Darren Randolph. If you're doing a depth chart, there's Darren Randolph, and it's a long way back till you get to one of Kieran O'Hara, Mark Travers, Caoimhín Kelleher. Now, ideally, one or two of those step up and get greater chances over the next couple of years. But it doesn't seem like there's anybody else.
No, it's not going to happen in the next 12 months, 18 months, realistically. It's hard to see any of them. Kieran O'Hara's played the most football, he's the oldest, but even, you know, unless he gets a better class of loan, you know, at the championship level or something.
Best thing for Mark Travers might be if Bournemouth get relegated.
Yeah, it's true. But Ramsdale is very young as well, too. So Kelleher is going to need to go on loan. Gavin Bazunu is coming through as well, but he's very young. It's a tough one because, again, there's always going to be lifestyle and financial factors, and he's 32. Okay, his deal, I think, was up at 2021 at Middlesbrough, but still, it's a 3.5-year contract, so it gives him security till, that would be up to 2023, wouldn't it? And it's back to London where he's had spent a certain amount of his time in his career. So I think it's hard to begrudge someone taking that opportunity. And I was surprised almost to read up and see Fabianski being described as like a star man in reports about West Ham, to the point that, like, is he enough of a star that he's completely immovable from that side? He's definitely number one when everyone's fit at the moment.
Well, I just remember reading, probably on The Athletic or a couple of different websites, those end of year, half season teams of the season so far outside of the top six. And Lukasz Fabianski was in almost all of them as the best goalkeeper outside the top six.
Yeah, and there was when he got his 3-month injury earlier this season, I think there were stories at the time. Now, his contract actually doesn't have that much left in it, but West Ham were at pains to try and point out they were looking to seek a long-term deal with him. So you don't know. Sometimes deals happen because there might be other stuff going on in the background with Fabianski. You never know. That would be a very glass half full view, but it mightn't be ideal, but I don't think it's a problem in the short term. Maybe come September we might be having a different discussion about it.
Still, Manchester United 1 Wolves 0 3 minutes to go at Old Trafford. The goal from Juan Mata has United on course for place in the fourth round, but maybe, well, not quite bigger because United needed to win this game. But Marcus Rashford came on as a substitute and then went off again. He was only on the pitch for 17 minutes. Looked as though it was an impact injury. He was just trying to twist. Though he went off sort of holding his hamstring. Maybe it was a dead leg or was just above the knee. But that'll certainly be a worry for Manchester United considering they take on Liverpool on Sunday at Anfield. We'll have that game for you live and off the ball. But obviously Rashford's very much been the star man this
season. Yeah, it would be a bit of a disaster if someone who tried to rest as a precaution but then needed is the victim from the game. But I don't know. I mean, that's a worry, but I think just getting through the tie at the moment as it stands.
They're nearly there. Another two minutes for Manchester United to hang on.
Although Pochettino's doing some gig today, isn't he, for La Liga in London, so I don't know what he's ended up saying or not.
We'll find out in the papers in the morning, I'm sure.
Yes, you will, yeah. You can.
Can't wait.
Or OTVAM can just read out the words.
Jeez, he never turns down the cash, though, does he? No, that's for sure. Wow.
Neutral beneficial, you know.
Just want to remind you that next Wednesday, January 22nd, Off the Ball's American football show, The Snap, will be on the road in association with the Aer Lingus College Football Classic. Mike Carlson and NFL superfan Mossy Quinn will be joining Jer, Ronan Mullen and Keane Fahey as we build up to one of the biggest events in the sporting calendar, Super Bowl 54. They're going to be live from the NFL room at the Woolshed in Dublin. You can get your tickets right now at offtheball.com/events. And remember, this show is over 18s only. It's all in association with the Aer Lingus College Football Classic. That is Navy against Notre Dame at the Aviva Stadium on August 29th. Check out collegefootballireland.com for game tickets and much more. Up next, we're going to be talking Tottenham with Charlie Eccleshire.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Geoff and Heskey.
All right, you're welcome back to Wednesday's football show. We want to turn our attention to Tottenham and what's been going on there since Jose Mourinho's arrival at the club. I'm joined on the line by Charlie Eccleshire of The Athletic. Evening, Charlie.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well. So whatever bounce Spurs thought they may get when Jose Mourinho arrived at the club, it certainly hasn't happened. Since he arrived, 7 victories, 5 losses, 2 draws. They've kept just 1 clean sheet in their last 17 matches, and there's a whole lot going on at the club. Still, we're unsure exactly what's happening with Christian Eriksen. Jadson Fernandez has arrived today on loan. There's all sorts of talk about what striker he may get, if he gets any. It's all a bit of a mess, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because there was the initial kind of bounce after a few games. And I think people were a little surprised because the end of the Pochettino reign had been so difficult. And then, you know, Mourinho came in and briefly there was an uptick. But yes, since then it's kind of slowed down. The loss to Chelsea just before Christmas kind of heralded a bit of a return to the end of the Pochettino era. And now it's a team that does still look a little bit like it's struggling for identity and purpose. So, yeah, lots of issues still at the club. Very interesting club to cover, I'd say.
Has there been a Mourinho style since he returned? Like, quite often when we think of Mourinho, it is that low defensive line, seen as ultra-defensive, particularly against the better sides, which maybe we saw at times against Liverpool last weekend. But has he come in with a definite plan of how he wanted to change Tottenham post-Pochettino?
Well, I think it's too early to really say that. He came in and initially was more attacking and more open than I think we were expecting. And certainly they went to United, Old Trafford, played with basically like 4 attackers, which, you know, most people wouldn't really associate with kind of, you know, Jose Mourinho team. Now, yeah, against Liverpool, you know, there was, I suppose, a slightly more defensive approach. That's been divisive amongst supporters. Personally, I think I can see the logic in what he was trying to do. But yeah, it's taking a little bit of time. I think he's wary of being seen to be that defensive, pragmatic coach. We've seen lots of different formations and personnel. It may be that it's not really until next season that he fully puts a stamp on this team. And look, the assumption always with Mourinho is that low block, as you say, the more reactive approach. So, you know, whether that's where this Spurs team ends up, I think, yeah, we'll have to wait a little bit longer than whatever it is, 13 game.
It'll be interesting to see what he does defensively, because 3 years ago, Spurs had probably the best defence in the country, and you looked at a back four at the time of, if it was Trippier, Alderweireld, Vertonghen and Rose, been pretty much as good as it gets. Alderweireld and Vertonghen are still there. They both had their injury problems, yet you still feel there's quality. Does he go and look to change that? Is Davinson Sanchez at the standard that Mourinho wants, or is that an area that he's going to be focusing on, do you think, next summer as he tries to put that stamp on the team?
It's a really interesting one, and this is something I actually wrote about today on The Athletic, is Mourinho's options at centre-back, where he actually has, you know, a good number of players. It's just trying to find the right combination, and he's chopped and changed that quite a lot, as did Pochettino before him. I think they played with something in total this season, like 8 partnerships at centre-back. Full-back-wise is arguably the biggest drop-off they've had. If you look back, as you mentioned, they had Trippier and Rose, and before then you had Kyle Walker and Rose. And when they came second in 2016-17 and got 86 points and were brilliant, those full-backs were so, so key. The drop-off now is pretty big. And, you know, Serge Aurier has actually played quite well. You know, since Mourinho's come in, but I know he's pretty divisive with Spurs fans. It's probably a generous way of putting it. You then have Ben Davis, who's injured. Rose is not the player he once was. Sessegnon, Mourinho says, isn't a fullback. So it's a strange situation in a way, because there are a lot of players there who can play in these various positions, but whether they are of the standard required or the sort of players that Mourinho wants, well, that's another question. I mean, Alderweireld signed a new contract. He's someone who's played until the Middlesbrough game and played every minute of Mourinho's reign. So he's clearly first choice. But then you're not sure about then who plays with him. Maybe Vertonghen. He still has to sign a new deal, and he's looked off the pace the last few weeks.
You talk about players sort of been interchangeable there. For a long time under Pochettino, that was definitely the case in midfield, and that they had a lot of midfielders, and you never were really sure if he was quite certain on what was the pick of the bunch. And think back to when he started and he had the likes of Bentaleb and Mason, and then he went with Wanyama and then Bele moving to Dyer and Winks, and now it feels as though Dyer and Winks aren't pretty much first choice under Jose Mourinho. Like, that's an area they've constantly struggled to nail down. Jedson Fernandez has come in. Is he seen as a replacement for Christian Eriksen, or are they looking to use him in a different part of the midfield?
No, he's more more of a replacement for Moussa Sissoko, who's obviously out for, could be more or less the whole of the season. He's more that kind of box-to-box player, very energetic. He's good going forward, has a good shot on him. So I think the kind of energy and drive that they lack without Sissoko, it's hope that he can compensate for. I mean, he's not a defensive midfielder, which is what I think a lot of fans are hoping would be the priority this window. And just to go back, what you say there is interesting about the central midfield, because really since Moussa Dembele left this time last year, and you know the kind of previous half season when physically he wasn't up to it, that's been a massive moment in the kind of regression of this Tottenham side, because he was so important to the way they played. He was the key man almost, and so replacing him has been a real challenge for them.
The signing of Jedson Fernandez, and I know it's an initial loan deal and potentially he could go for £42 million, €50 million if it all goes well. Does that sum up where Tottenham still are financially, that they're not in a position, certainly not in a January transfer window, to go and spend £50 million up front? I mean, up front in terms of paying it straight away rather than for an attacking player, but that they can't go and spend that money right now?
Whether it's can or an unwillingness to, I think is
Well, which is it, do you think?
Well, look, they could, but it would go against the kind of principles that those who run the club have. You know, they're not a club who wants to go out and spend vast sums in one go. A deal like this, and it's what they did with the Chelsea as well, it's kind of an insurance policy, because if it doesn't work out and he doesn't adapt to the Premier League, then they can just say, thanks, but we're not taking you. But if it does, then they've got this option to buy him. So it makes sense from that point of view. January as well is harder to do business. You are almost by definition dealing with players who've fallen out of favour at their clubs. And that's not always a tempting proposition. So, you know, this is the reality, and Mourinho knew this was the reality. I think in the summer you might see, you know, a bit more outgoing on players, but for January, Spurs aren't a club who've spent a lot of money. You know, you look in the last sort of 6 years, they bought Dele Alli in January 2015, but that was he got loaned back straight away, so he didn't come to the following season. So other than that, it's Lucas Moura, and that's it, a couple of years ago. So This is how they operate, and Mourinho says he's cool with that, so we'll have to see.
Yeah, in terms of those financials and Champions League qualification, so currently they're 9 points off Chelsea in fourth. How important is it to what they want to do then during the summer that they finish in the top four? Or did Mourinho come, considering the position in the table they were in the knowledge that they may not finish inside Champions League football, they may not have that financial boost, and he's prepared for that, that he may not get the money he wants, that they're probably, I presume like any club, there's two different budgets depending on where they finish?
Yeah, I mean, when he came in, they were 11 points off the top four. So, as you say, that was always, the likelihood was that they wouldn't. And, you know, this it's a well-run club. It hasn't mortgaged its future on that. But, yes, it will have an impact. And I think Spurs are probably one of the more precarious of that big six, you know, in the sense that they're not a United or a club like that who, whether they're in the Champions League or not, will always be able to attract the absolute best players and will be able to throw money at it. They're not going to do that. So I think there is a concern, certainly amongst supporters, that, you know, not qualifying for the Champions League would be pretty catastrophic in that respect. And then for Mourinho, yeah, that's the big challenge. And this is what I find fascinating, the extent to which, you know, he was okay with the fact that it's going to be a very different project to what he's been used to. You know, he's been at clubs that have spent a lot of money. Not really going to be like that, especially if they don't qualify for the Champions League. He says, you know, he knew that was going to be the situation. He's cool with it. But fascinating to see how that plays out if that is the way it goes and they don't get top four.
Considering where they were, as you say, 11 points off top four, and it just felt as everything around the club had stalled, unfortunately, under Maurizio Pochettino in those last few months. From Daniel Levy's point of view, and even Mourinho's, What do you think they saw as the end and do see as the end of this Jose Mourinho project? Is it getting them back as a regular top four team? Is there a hope that by year three, Mourinho can have them back competing for a title?
Yeah, I think that the priority is to keep them as a Champions League club, which Pochettino did. You know, he established them as a club, you know, I think it was four seasons in a row. You know, they're just someone who we expect to see in there. Big thing is trophies as well. You know, Mourinho, his major point of difference from Pochettino is that he is a serial winner. You know, Pochettino, for all his brilliance, that's the one glaring omission on his CV, whereas that is something Mourinho's done everywhere he's been, even at United, which we think of as such a disappointment. Mm. He still won the Europa League and the League Cup in his first season. So I think, you know, keep them in the top four, get a trophy, end this drought. I mean, it's 2008 since they last won anything, which is pretty crazy for a club of Spurs standing. So I think that's, you know, that's massive, and that's why an FA Cup run is important, and why yesterday was a big relief that they're still in the competition.
Christian Eriksen, is that a done deal, do you think, that he's going to be gone probably, well, in the next few days, Inter Milan?
I think he will go this month, probably. I wouldn't say it's a done deal yet, just because where Inter are and where Tottenham are, is there's quite a big gap. And I think the reports on the weekend, my understanding is they were a little premature. Eriksen, you know, threw his shirt off and seemed to be saying goodbye, but then he was playing again 3 days later. So still work to be done on that front, but it's increasingly looking as though it will happen. But it may take a few days, or even, you know, we've got, a couple of weeks till the window closes, and, you know, it may be that it goes to the wire a little bit.
For the rest of January then, and what Spurs might do, Eriksen's departure, how much of a priority is a replacement for Eriksen, considering, I assume, top of the list now that Jenson Fernandez is there, is getting somebody in to step in for Harry Kane for the next 3 or 4 months?
Yeah, Kane is a bigger priority. But again, it's not a guarantee that something will happen there. You know, there are some names being bandied around, and Piatek at Milan was one of them. But again, the Milan's valuation of Spurs is very different. Some other names have been mentioned. You know, I've been told that there's no guarantee with any of them. And you know, Spurs are going to wait and see. They're not going to be ripped off. The problem they have is that every club knows that Kane's out for possibly the season. Has them over the barrel a little bit, over a barrel, but that's not, you know, they're not going to do a silly deal. So if they have to wait it out, as frustrating and as galling as that would be the lesser of two evils compared to paying way over the odds for someone that Levy and the club don't think is worth it.
Troy Parrott's situation then, there's probably two very different views, I'd imagine, on Troy Parrott. There's the Irish interest who are sort of ignoring his age and just looking at the promise and the talent and what we want Troy Parrott to go on to be. And there's the more Jose Mourinho realistic point, which is he's 17 years of age, he's only been over in England for about 18 months, and that you're never going to throw a 17-year-old in as a replacement for Harry Kane. He made those comments last week that, you know, I don't have another striker, I don't have a backup for Harry Kane, which I think frustrated a lot of people, certainly in this country, as to what sort of chance Parrott may get over the next few months. Do you think if they don't sign someone, his chances do increase, or is it just a case that, look, he's 17, no matter what happens, he's probably not going to get much game time?
Yeah, I mean, the view amongst the sort of Tottenham fan base, certainly in social media, is similar to what you described in Ireland. And I did feel a little bit like I was telling kids that Santa Claus wasn't real when I tweeted Mourinho's quote saying that Parrott probably wouldn't get a huge amount of game time because there is this massive clamour for him to play. I think realistically, he's not going to play a huge amount this season. As you say, you know, Mourinho's was pretty explicit and said, you know, he's 17, let's give this guy time. He's a baby in footballing terms. His chances would increase if there aren't, if no one comes in. But I think he would only play if, you know, they suffered some more injuries. Because yesterday's quite a good example in that, you know, there was kind of an outcry that he wasn't on the bench against Middlesbrough for an FA Cup game, which I totally understand. But then when you see that the two subs, the two attacking subs for Mourinho are Son and Ali, it's kind of like, okay, that gives you some idea of sort of the pecking order, certainly in Mourinho's eyes. So I'd love to see Parrott play. I think, you know, it's always so exciting having those young players, but we might need to just be a little bit patient on that one. Sorry to be the bearer of bad news.
Cut him off now. Ruined our hopes.
Saying something else.
You mentioned earlier on how, you know, Spurs is at the moment a fascinating club to cover. You think back to 3 years ago, 4 years ago, when they were competing for titles, and it was such a brilliant young crop of players, and Mauricio Pochettino was very much at its peak, and it was such an exciting club to cover, and they were at that position where they're probably everybody's second favourite team, where people wanted to watch them every time you saw them play. The trickery, the technical ability, the way they were set up, everything felt special and they were going places, but also in the back of your mind that if they didn't take their chance soon, it may pass them by. Do you get the sense from being around the club that maybe some of those younger players who are now hitting 24, 25 feel that that chance for trophies, for real success, has passed them by?
That's a really interesting one. I don't know if consciously they would feel that. I think there's a feeling amongst some players that there was a really big opportunity, and certainly amongst fans, there was such a massive opportunity to capitalise on this incredible foundation that was there. And through a combination of maybe not investing as much as many would have liked, not being ruthless enough with players who had maybe reached about the peak of their powers and should have been moved on, but there has been a bit of a missed opportunity, you know, to make that step up from kind of, you know, finishing second or third to going and winning the title. And I think as much as it's, you know, players thinking, you know, have we missed a chance? Now some of them are at the point where they just think, maybe I'd like to do something else. You know, I've been at the same place for 5 or 6 years, hearing up until November the same voices, and it's just time for a change. I think that feeling is there amongst some players. And then it just, you know, this summer's going to be fascinating. How many have moved on? How ruthless is this cull? How quickly can you execute, you know, a big rebuilding job? Because clearly there are a lot of players now who you think a move might be good for them as well as the club. And so, yeah, big decisions for Mourinho coming up for sure.
All right. Good stuff, Charlie. Thanks for taking the call.
Cool. Thanks a lot.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Shearer and Owen.